walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Dr. Peter Rourke, a retired orthopedic surgeon and pilot who co-founded Dog Is My Co-Pilot, a Wyoming-based organization that flies animals from shelters with low adoption rates and often high euthanasia rates to shelters elsewhere in the country where the reverse is true, significantly boosting the prospects of those dogs, and in some cases cats, being adopted. Dog Is My Co-Pilot is typically pulling from about 20 facilities where lack of space makes the animals more likely candidates for being euthanized and delivers them to some 60 rescue organizations where there's a greater likelihood of landing in their forever home. These rescue groups are located across a span of 15 states or thereabouts. It's good to know someone with an airplane. We'll hear what prompted this physician to launch the organization, how they decide which shelters and rescues to work with, the logistics involved in planning the flights, how many animals they've flown, and more when I speak with Dr. Peter Rourke in a moment here on Talking Animals. Later in the show, I'll speak with Frank Cherubino, a columnist at the Palm Beach Post, who tweeted a picture of an iguana who paralyzed from the 40-degree temperatures in last week's cold snap in South Florida, was stretched out near the edge of Cherubino's pool. The iguana turned out to be fine, but boy, did the photo go viral, appearing online in newspapers and on television across the world. Lastly, as a prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be giving away a pair of tickets to see a comedy show this Sunday, January 14th, at The Attic, headlined by veteran comic Mark Price, who some of you may remember as Skippy on Family Ties. Meanwhile, let's get to Dr. Rourke with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Dr. Peter Rourke on Talking Animals. Good morning, Dr. Rourke.
Good morning, Duncan. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks so much for joining me on Talking Animals. And let's start, if we could, at the most elemental level. There's no Dog as my co-pilot, or at least no flights, if there's no Dr. Rourke. So let's take it all the way back, actually. When did you start flying?
Oh, gosh, I've been flying just about my whole life. I started my first pilot's license at the lessons at the age of 12. I soloed on my 16th birthday, which is the minimal age, and got my license on my 17th birthday, which is the minimum age. I always thought that I would be an airline pilot growing up, something with aviation, but I was sidetracked by my interest with the sciences and had an opportunity to go to medical school, so I went in that direction instead.
Yeah, so you just became sort of a crummy orthopedic surgeon instead of, right? Yeah, you just have to put up with that, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I settled.
Yeah, that's right. So I want to explore this idea because, I mean, that's, I think, precocious by any standard about your interest and love for flying. I mean, what first grabbed you about the idea of flying a plane? I mean, if you were first getting up in one and learning to fly at 12, do you remember, like, what was driving you then? What appealed to you?
Gosh, it was always in my blood. Always wanted to fly. I thought maybe I should have been a bird. But was always fascinated with aviation, even at a very young age. Checked out all the books from the libraries that had how to fly an airplane, how to build an airplane. I mean, it was almost totally consuming. Actually thought about in college becoming an aeronautical engineer, but, you know, as I mentioned, the biological sciences kind of shanghaied me.
I'd be curious to know, given that, I mean, because that is, I think, an unusual, both early and intense passion. So once you got up in the air, maybe not necessarily the first time, but maybe then, maybe some of the first few times, how did it compare? Did it live up to what you had envisioned when you were sort of dreaming about getting up there?
Oh, yeah. Of the top 10 moments of my life, one of the top 10 is the first time I soloed an aircraft. And that airplane looks awfully empty when you're flying it by yourself for the very first time, flying it around the patch. And it was definitely a thrill of a lifetime.
Well, also, yeah, I would think for those of us who don't fly, thinking about doing that at any age, I would think that would be sort of a thrilling moment. But doing it at 16, when many of us are just sort of barely driving a car around without banging into somebody, I mean, that just seems all the more kind of a transcendent moment.
Yeah, interesting, because I was born and raised in New Jersey, of all places, and they have a driving age of 17. So I actually had my pilot's license before I had my driver's license.
Wow, that is funny. So for those of us, as I say, I mean, most of us haven't flown a plane. For those of us that are in that situation, I mean, what all over all these years, like, how would you, if you could sort of summarize it? I mean, obviously, I get a sense that it's exhilarating for you. It was every bit of what you had hoped for. What's that really like to just be up there? And yeah, there's no roads, there's no signals, there's no crazy other, well, for the most part, traffic that you have to contend with, at least compared to so around town or freeway or whatever. So what is that really like?
Well, it definitely is a sense of freedom. I mean, the actual thrill of flying for me is really, it's disappeared. I've been flying for almost 50 years now. I now use it as a tool to get from A to B and morphed into saving animals in the process. But, you know, the basics are keep the shiny side up and the greasy side down. You push in on the yoke and the earth gets bigger. You pull back and the earth gets smaller.
Well, spoken like somebody who's been doing it for a long time, and I'm sure obviously doing it very well, because just like with anything else, whether it's athletics or any other kind of thing, I mean, if you do something a long time and do it well, it seems effortless, it looks effortless to the rest of us, but I think it's probably a little bit more involved than what you've described, but I sort of get your
point.
Well,
certainly, you know, the saying is that there are old pilots and bold pilots, but there are no old bold pilots.
Let that be a lesson. Yeah.
Yes.
So I gotcha. So along the way, as we've kind of alluded to, amidst all that flying, you indeed did manage to squeeze in a career as an orthopedic surgeon. Now, by most accounts, medical school, and especially the internships and other training that follow that, can be quite grueling. But I get the sense that you maintained your love of and therefore the actual practice of flying even through those periods.
Oh, yes. Never gave it up. Always had an airplane. Always seemed to scratch together the funds that was necessary. I had an old airplane that was like a Rolls Canardly. It would roll down the runway and Canardly get off when it gets to the end. And so I kept that, and that was my respite on the weekends when I had some spare time. Take it up and bore some holes in the sky with that. And I always thought that I would incorporate flying as part of my practice, and indeed I did when I was practicing. I practiced in Wyoming for years, and I had a large geographic draw, and it's difficult sometimes for patients to drive 3 or 4 hours to go see their doctor to get sutures removed. So what I would do, I would fly to the outlying communities and go see these patients and actually see them in the airport lounge and do their exams there and their follow-up care.
Wow, that's a pretty cool wrinkle on the old-style house call, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it sounds like really, especially as you talk about on weekends, even while in med school or the training that followed that, that for you, among other things, that flying was what for a lot of others might be golf or poker or some other kind of hobby, but obviously more powerful than that.
Yeah, fortunately, I'm a much better pilot than I am a golfer.
I see. Okay, that's good. Let me let folks know this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Dr. Peter Rourke, a retired orthopedic surgeon and pilot who co-founded Dog Is My Co-Pilot, which flies animals from shelters in one part of the country to another expressly to boost their prospects of being adopted. If you'd like to ask Dr. Rourke a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org or text 813 813- 833-433-0885. So when it comes to launching Dog as your co-pilot, the lifelong love of flying makes perfect sense, of course. Being an orthopedic surgeon, I guess we see how making those sort of variations of house calls kind of ties in. But there must be another piece of this puzzle. Tell me, like, what role animals have played in your life, whether early on in your own life growing up or as you were raising a family. Where were animals important? I figure that that's got to be some part of this narrative here.
Well, I grew up with dogs. I always had dogs.
Okay.
Our family always had one or two. And at the time, they were just part of the family. I mean, it's just it was an important part. And I've always had animals. I have two dogs now, two rescues that I was able to pluck from the transports that I was doing. And so it's important to me. And if people who don't have dogs clearly don't understand, because if they did, they would have a dog.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think that is often said and written about our president, amongst others, but that's a whole nother topic or discussion for another time. So, okay. So longtime dog lover, and obviously, as we know now, longtime pilot. Tell me the ceiling for how those kind of loves intersected.
Well, there's an organization out there called Pilots in Paws, where mm-hmm. You can sign up on their website as a pilot, or if you have a need, you can go to the website. And they'll match a pilot with an animal that needs transport. And I would do that on occasion, but it's incredibly inefficient in terms of trying to save animals. Now, if you're flying one dog on one trip on one time, and for that dog, it's a game changer. But you can really, if you're going to do it full time, you can really run out of resources very quickly. So I did that for a couple of years while I was still practicing. And after I left my practice in 2012, devoted my full-time efforts to Dog as my co-pilot. I want to give a shout-out to Judy Zimmett, who co-founded the Dog is my co-pilot with me. She's an attorney and got our 501c3, and we were off to the races after that. We made every mistake you could possibly make in transporting animals. We started small and could transport 20 or 30 animals at a time, and now we have a much larger aircraft, and we've had up to 250 animals on board at one time.
So it sounds like, Dr. Warwick, that part of it was, based on your early experience there volunteering with Pilots in Paws, kind of deciding to build a better mousetrap, I guess, is one way to put it, just because it sounded like you were happy to do it, and it was, of course, an extension of your love of both flying and dogs. But it sounded like you found that, hey, this is great for the, like you said, for that dog or those three dogs or whatever, but there must be a way to do this on a larger scale that is more efficient and helps more animals. So was that kind of the operating principle when you decided to launch your own organization?
Yeah, exactly that. I was introduced to Marty Watts, who runs the San Francisco Humane Society, and we were trying to set up a relationship between Jackson Hole and San Francisco, and Marty said, there's a woman that you need to meet in Merced, California, and it's Sharon Lohman, who runs New Beginnings. So I went down to Merced, and this place was completely overrun. I mean, they were euthanizing 94% of the dogs that came through the door.
Ugh, yikes.
The only option, these folks have three options. They can adopt them out, they can transport them, or they can put them down. Yeah. And these are otherwise perfectly healthy and adoptable animals. And so what they were desperate. They would load 20, 30 animals in the back of a van, and they'd drive to Seattle, which is a 14-hour drive. And, you know, once a dog is in the crate, they stay in that crate until they get to their destination. And it's not as if you stop and let them out to pee. So I told Sharon that I was going to do that for her. And so I learned how to run this organization based on my experiences with Sharon, and then that quickly multiplied. Suddenly, we were getting requests from all over. We still get the occasional request to fly one animal from Atlanta to Los Angeles, which clearly would be very inefficient use of our resources.
And in that case, Dr. Work, do you just say, well, hang on, I mean, I don't know if in that case there's like sort of a medical or other urgency to it. But in those cases now, you say, well, hang on, we can probably help, but let's help that dog as part of a much larger group that we hope to be flying on 6 days or whatever the response might. Is that how you would respond to that kind of request now?
Most of that is actually handled by Kara Pollard, who's our executive director, is just a genius at getting all this done and getting it all organized, because you can imagine how many moving parts there are in getting this done. And also weather is an issue. We try not to fly when the weather's really bad. Sometimes we can't avoid it, but fortunately the aircraft can handle it, and I'm trained to do it. But it's a lot more fun when the weather's nice.
Okay, so a couple questions. First is to back up. Because of your great passion for flying, and as we've learned now, you have a similar passion perhaps for dogs. As much as I was kind of kidding around at the beginning of our conversation here, did practicing medicine ultimately sort of become like, well, this is kind of an inconvenience because I'd rather be just flying generally, of course, but also flying in the benefit of these dogs. So maybe it is time to retire from my practice so I can really free up those big hunks of time.
Well, I actually love practicing orthopedic surgery. I mean, that was really who I was for 30 years. And it was the sudden death of my wife in 2012 that prompted me to leave medicine. I just couldn't go back and do it after seeing what she had been through.
I see. I'm sorry to hear that.
So okay. I decided, this is the time. I mean, after you go through that grieving process and you come out of that dark place and you start looking around, and I knew I wasn't going back to medicine, and I always thought that I would get into animal rescue using the aircraft, and so reached out to Judy Zimmett, and we just got it wheels up.
That's really great. So let's talk a little bit about how that works. I mean, it sounds like from what you're saying that the work that Kara does is critical, but because I would think that you've got, as you say, a number of moving parts, including whatever shelters or facilities that the dogs and I guess occasionally the cats are coming from, and then where they're going to, and I don't know if it's all just one trip or if there are multiple trips. And again, you're obviously trying to make the best use of the flight time, the fuel, your time, et cetera. So it seems like there's a lot of things to juggle there. So let's just take a moment so we can really get a sense of the mechanics and just the organizational kind of challenges there. Let's look at maybe the most recent flight, whenever that was. Can you just sort of walk me through that? Let's go sort of blow by blow, like how the most recent flight worked, how many animals were there, and what it took to get those animals kind of organized and scheduled, and then where your destination or destinations, plural, may have been.
Well, you're absolutely right. When we first started and we were flying a small aircraft, the Cessna Stationera 206, we would load 20 animals and pick up in one location and drop off in one location. But now that we're flying hundreds of animals at a time, there's no one facility that can take in all those animals. So the most recent trip was out of Las Cruces, New Mexico, and that trip went to Salt Lake City, to Boise, to Missoula, to Thompson Falls, and then to Polson, Montana, the last three cities in Montana. And so the organizations down south, believe me, there's no shortage of animals. And we don't do the choosing of the animals. The receiving groups do. So the receivers work with the sender, and they'll pick and choose the animal. The folks will properly vet the animal, make sure it certainly is adoptable, because the last thing we want is a dog that has to be returned because of behavioral issues or mm-hmm. The dogs are, we meet at the airport typically around 5 in the morning. We crate the animals, and then we tag them, color code the tags depending on the destinations, and the dogs that are last out are going to be loaded first. But there is a weight and balance issue with the aircraft, and we're flying all kinds of sizes of dogs between 8 pounds and 80 pounds, so you can't put all the big dogs in the tail of the aircraft. You'll never get off the ground. So we load them, and it's a huge game of Tetris trying to get all these different size crates in and using up all the space, and when we get to the receiving organization, we usually ask for at least 4 people there to help load and unload the dogs, close up the door, kick the tires, light the fires, and then we're off to the next stop. So these trips typically last about 8 hours for me. And keep in mind that if you wanted to transport a dog from Tampa to Orlando, that's not the kind of trip that we would consider because...
Wouldn't make sense.
You could put them in a van or a car and drive.
Sure.
So we do that long-distance transportation that geographically expands the areas where these dogs can be adopted and where it makes no sense to drive. So my typical flight is going to be 5 hours to the first stop. And that's a lot of time sitting in an aircraft playing Sudoku and watching the world go by.
Right. And so, like, when you said, the trip might be 8 hours, so does that mean that, like, the trip you just described that started in Salt Lake City and went to Boise and Missoula, et cetera, I mean, that the entire trip with unloading the animals at each of those stops, et cetera, spanned just 8 hours total?
Typically about 8 hours flight time.
Okay.
And that started in Las Cruces. But
the really long days
are the trips that we fly out of New Orleans or San Antonio, Texas. They're 12 hours in the air during that. That's a long day.
Yeah. And how often in a given week or whatever sort of period do these flights happen?
Well, we're kind of in a downtime right now because of the winter weather. Keep in mind that the areas where we fly, it's typically over the Rocky Mountains or over the Sierras or over the Cascades. And flying in a single-engine aircraft in bad weather over the mountains, I mean, what possibly could go wrong?
Ugh.
So we tend to be fair weather flyers during the winter months because of the icing conditions that can occur and accumulate on the aircraft.
Sure.
But our heavy flying months will start in April and run through till mid-November. And we'll fly two or three trips a week on those trips. And last year alone, I flew over 500 hours, and we saved over 2,500 animals and flew our number 8,000th animal to rescue.
So. Yeah, well, I was going to ask that. I mean, that's because I think, if I'm not mistaken, I don't have it in front of me, but I believe the organization was launched in 2012. Were there
that's
about?
Correct, yeah.
So that's 8,000 animals in a relatively short period. That's, so you are doing some serious flying and some serious crating up that plane and making...
Yeah, for the first 3 years, we were flying the smaller aircraft, and so we were flying about 1,000 animals per year. And then when we got the Cessna Caravan, we easily doubled those numbers, so it's about 2,500 a year. And we're looking forward to celebrating our number 10,000 this year. That's a huge milestone for us.
And Dr. Work, are there, now that you're that many years in and that many animals flown, and then presumably in most cases, if not all, then finding their forever home, have there been other pilots either that have contacted you or vice versa so as to further expand the number that dogs might co-pilot could serve?
Well, certainly there are no shortage of pilots who want to walk up to the airplane and fly someone else's aircraft.
Okay.
We have a large number of very generous people who donate to Dog as My Co-Pilot, but it falls short. So a large chunk of that, the resources, come out of my own pocket to keep this afloat. And I'm happy to do that. And if another pilot wants to come along and help buy the fuel and maintain the aircraft, I mean, I'm happy to have them on board.
Sure.
But a lot of these pilots are low-time pilots. They're just looking to build time, and I don't need any time builders. I need some dog enthusiasts.
I see. So it sounds like you are hearing from folks, but not necessarily people that are a particularly good fit for what you need.
And if they're working full time doing something else, I mean, it's. When I'm not flying, I'm writing thank you notes, and when I'm not writing thank you notes, I'm flying. So it really is a full-time job.
It sure sounds like it. When you described earlier the way that the animals get crated and color-coded and stuff, but nonetheless that because of weight distribution, not all the blue tags can probably be together. So is there, what kind of concern or maybe what kind of misadventures may there have been where dog intended for Boise got off in Missoula or vice versa?
Sadly, it happens.
Yeah.
But these groups work really well with each other, and they're very accommodating, and they know that if we get it right 99% of the time, I mean, that works well. So if a crate is mislabeled or mismarked, or if I have to unload a large number of crates because of the weight and balance and then reload them and we didn't get one up back on, the groups, they don't get angry about that. They know it's part of the process, and Everybody is on the same page. We're all on the same team, trying to save as many of these animals as possible. And we transport only from one nonprofit to another nonprofit, and we only transport from the high kill facilities to a non-kill facility. And we never charge the senders. We never charge the receivers. We get a couple grants every year that help, but most of the money that we run on are just donations from your listeners and the people who follow us on our Facebook page.
Yeah. Well, with that in mind, I should say that the website is simply dogcopilot.org to find out more. And again, if you like what you're hearing and feel like you want to help support the next flight, that's the place to find out how to do that. But so I would doubt then from what you're saying, that if no one is ever paying a dime and you're helping these groups on both sides, that it'd be pretty surprising for someone to say, "Darn it, Dr. Rourke, that dog was supposed to get off in Salt Lake City." I mean, so
right.
And I imagine that's fairly easily corrected within some reasonable amount of time, or I'm sure there's ways to solve
these
that.
These dogs are all perfectly adoptable, and they've all been vetted, and so it's just if they're getting 30 and they get 31 instead, or so, and the mistakes happen on both ends.
Yeah,
both
no, I'm
senders,
sure
the receivers, the pilot. I mean, we're all making mistakes together, but we fortunately communicate really well, and Kara keeps a very tight communication path going. So the mistakes are very unusual. They're not common.
Yeah, I'm sure. Again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Dr. Peter Rourke, who co-founded Dog Is My Co-Pilot, which, again, flies animals from shelters in one part of the country to another in order to make it more likely for those animals to be adopted. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So we do have some emails or texts that I'll get to. One is just, I guess, kind of a comment. It says, "In Central Florida, Sebring, Arcadia, Wachula, and more, it's hard to get animals adopted out. Any chance of including these communities on your route? God bless you." And that's Sarah from DeSoto County. So feel free to answer however you like, but I gather from what you said that it's more the groups on both ends that sort of work this out and coordinate rather than the Dog Is My Co-Pilot folks.
Yeah, we try to do the vertical organization from the senders, the transport, and the receivers, and it actually drove us crazy.
Yeah.
So if there's a sending group that can find a receiving group and they can fill the aircraft and it makes sense for us to transport financially and using what limited resources we have, we'll take the trip.
Yeah.
And I mean, we were in New Orleans a couple years ago for the flood dogs, did a couple trips out of there. We did four trips out of Texas, got out one day before the hurricane hit, and then went back three more times after that. And a lot of people were asking, you know, why aren't you going down there sooner? And really, what we were doing is transporting the dogs that were already in shelters to make room for dogs that had been separated from their families. Because the last thing we want to do is have a dog that is just lost. They're never going to find that dog in Spokane, Washington.
Right, so. Right. Then you're compounding the problem rather than helping solve it.
Exactly. So. But the numbers are what we do. Basically, it costs us about $500 an hour to run the aircraft. And so we ask for at least 100 animals, and our typical flight is about 10 hours. So that's about $50 per animal per transport, which is a reasonable cost for an animal adoption. I mean, the shelters are spending way more than that. When spay and neuter, five-way vaccination, you know, feeding these dogs, bathing them, et cetera. And so if someone calls and said, "Well, we have 20 dogs and we're in someplace in Mule Shoe, Texas, and can you take them, you know, to Spokane?" I mean, that just doesn't make sense. And there are plenty of shelters closer that we can service more efficiently.
Sure.
The last thing we want to do is have to explain to the people who are donating their hard-earned money to Dog Is My Co-Pilot, and they And if it appears that we're not being smart or we're squandering the money, then really I'm not taking full responsibility for keeping the organization moving in the right direction.
For sure. So I guess this emailer and maybe others listening could certainly go to dogcopilot.org, and there's contact information for Kara, the executive director that you mentioned. So they could inquire, I guess, about what the prospects are, knowing that, as you just explained, sometimes it really does come down to mathematics and dollars about how practical it would be to
Sadly, it does.
Yeah.
It's, you know, there are 4 million animals in shelters in this country, and half of them don't make it out alive. And, you know, every 3 seconds, an otherwise healthy and perfectly adoptable animal is being euthanized in this country. And so it's not a dog problem. It's a people problem.
Yeah.
And so they just need to understand, you need to spay and neuter. And you need to adopt, don't shop. I mean, I get my dogs out of the shelters, and they're terrific.
Sure.
And more loyal than my own children. No, I'm kidding.
Okay.
Sorry, guys.
I'll take that up with them in a moment, but I've got a couple of them holding here. But and that's the other thing, is that just the way things go, which, again, I think people that would listen to this show are aware of, probably more about car, van, bus, truck kind of transport. But still, the idea is that, as it turns out, there are just places in certain parts of the country that are limited in terms of space, or tapped out on their space, or for any number of reasons, unfortunately, do have a high euthanasia rate. And so if animals can be moved from there to, because there are, again, for reasons that may not be clearly explainable to everybody right off the bat, other facilities or certainly rescue groups in distinctly different parts of the country that say, hey, we don't even have enough animals to adopt out, or we could use more at the moment, or we're kind of in a slow period, then that gets those animals out of a pretty dark fate, perhaps, and into, with any luck, a forever home.
Right. And for the logistical purposes for our flights, I mean, I need to get them there in one day, and because I can't overnight with 120 animals
back
to the aircraft.
Yeah.
So, fortunately, here in the Northwest, we have a lot of cities that are exactly like that. They're clamoring for dogs. They have a lot of empty spaces in their facilities.
So yeah,
the cities like Portland and Seattle and Spokane and Boise and Missoula and Jackson and Denver and Salt Lake, and they're terrific.
I mean, yeah,
and I'm flying to them constantly, and I'm just wondering how do they manage taking care of all these animals. But, and the other point I want to make is that, you know, everybody's interested in the guy with the airplane, but the real heroes are the people who are working in these shelters, in there every day, socializing the animals, feeding them, cleaning out the stalls, walking the dogs, exercising them, and they're in there day in and day out. My involvement with these animals lasts about 8 hours. You know, I meet them at the airport, we load them up carefully, fly them to their destination, unload them, and I go home and have a beer. And then my day's over. And then for these other folks, their day is just starting. And they may hang on to these animals for a number of weeks before they can get them adopted out. Those are the real heroes.
No, absolutely. I mean, people that work at shelters and just rescue groups, whatever, are incredible people. For the purpose of this discussion, though, the guy with the plane and with the 50 years or so of flying experience is pretty central to the operation, so let's not overlook
that. I'm kind of the middle piece.
And, yeah.
And fortunately, what our organization does is it allows them to consider moving a dog from San Antonio to Boise, Idaho.
Yeah.
Which would be 27 hours in a car.
Ugh. You know, it's just not possible.
It's not possible.
Yeah.
So we make the impossible possible, which makes us feel good about us.
For sure. So we're just in the last moment or two, Dr. Work, but let me get to at least one or two more emails or texts if I could. One just simply asks, in terms of, I guess, maybe tying into our conversation about things that happen or just the length of the flight and trying to limit that. But this says, what is the ratio of the animals that get sick on their journey?
Well, that's a very good question.
Yeah.
And because just as people get motion sickness, some of these dogs and cats get motion sickness as well, and sadly for them, they're in the crate, and so whatever goes into the crate with them stays in the crate until we get to the destination. And that's why I've learned not to wear any nice clothing when I'm flying on these things, because it can be a real mess.
Yeah.
But we'll usually have one or two animals that will get air sick or have some sort of bowel issues, and yeah, I'm sitting in the aircraft with them, so I'm breathing the same air they are. So it can be a real challenge, and I don't have a window that I can open. So it can be a real challenge.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Wow. And here's something I actually don't know anything about, but I'm just going to pass it along for you to respond to if you're inclined to. But this emailer says, hi, Duncan, could your guest speak about, all of a sudden this isn't coming up. But, oh, there it is. Okay. Could your guest speak about the recent controversy about Soaring Paws, the nonprofit run by Albert Adams? I think that the state of Florida put criminal charges on Adams for lying to donors about Soaring Paws money management or mismanagement.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that at all.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't either. It didn't ring a bell with me, but I just thought it might in your world. And then in your world, especially with where you sort of were helping out even while you were still practicing medicine, you know, not long after we had scheduled this interview, I saw that another MD and pilot who flew rescued animals had gone off course in a flight and I guess presumably had died. What sort of impact does sort of tragic news like that have on you, Dog, as my co-pilot, just... or is it just kind of a sad anomaly?
I'm familiar with that, and apparently the gentleman had a medical event while he was flying. The aircraft was on autopilot, and it just kept going until it ran out of fuel.
I see. Yeah.
So, and I do fly by myself. I used to fly with my dog Doyle, and if you look at our logo, there's a black lab flying the aircraft. That was that was my dog Doyle.
Oh wow! Okay.
And it's, you know, I exercise every day, and so I try to stay healthy. And
yeah.
But I do get the occasional, you know, people voicing their concerns about me flying by myself. But it's it leaves up more room in the aircraft. I'll put animals in the front seat with me.
Sure.
I mean, it's just, every available space except the cargo pod will get cats and dogs in there.
And before we go, any other sort of misadventure, either in the early days or more recently, with dogs either busting out of crates or some sort of thing that...
Once a month, I'll have a dog that will escape from their crate.
Okay.
And they'll... But these crates are usually packed so tightly...
There's not much room.
They can't get around, but if it's not as crowded, they'll work their way right up front to me. And you know, I don't know these dogs, but they certainly seem friendly enough. The other thing that I never even gave thought to was that I do a lot of flights out of the Bay Area, Oakland, and Sacramento, and it's very humid in these locations. And so, when we're loading up the aircraft, you can imagine 150 panting dogs, and all the, you know, moisture from their breath is coming out, and so. You know, you can think of your high school prom night in the back of the Volkswagen Beetle and the windows being all fogged up. Well, that happens to my instrument panel as well. And so I carry a handkerchief and I'm constantly wiping down the panel so I could even read the instruments and the inside of the windscreen. So
wow. That's a pretty vivid scene there, Dr. Rourke. Yeah. So.
That can be a challenge. So.
Yeah. Well, this is all sounds great and just so wonderful that you do this. We've been speaking with Dr. Peter Rourke. Again, the organization is called Dog Is My Copilot. The website is dogcopilot.org. And just going to read this last emailer that wrote in. Dr. Rourke is awesome. Big exclamation mark. Thank you for doing such great work. So that's the perfect note on which to leave it. And I agree. So Dr. Rourke, thanks so much for joining us on Talking Animals and all your great work saving all these dogs with all these cool flights.
Thank you, Duncan. My final comment is that if you need to go by your shelter and adopt a dog. And if you can't adopt a dog, then you should go foster a dog and open up a space. And if you can't foster a dog, then volunteer at the shelter and help them out. And if you can't do that, you need to donate to your local shelter. A lot of good people put in a lot of hours and a lot of their own pocket money. And so the more people that help, the easier the problem will be to resolve. So
agreed. And those things aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. People could do two, three, or four of those
all
things.
Four.
Yeah, absolutely.
That would be. Those are the awesome
people. All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Rourke, and good luck with the next round of flights.
Yes, thank you so much for your time, and thank you, your listeners, for tuning in.
All right. Thanks again. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
In a few moments, I'll speak with Frank Cherubino, the Palm Beach Post columnist, whose photo of an iguana near his swimming pool during last week's cold snap went viral and then some. Right now, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner, where we'll be hearing a piece from a comic we haven't featured here before. His name is Ahmed Barucha, with a piece called Crows and Cows in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
I had about 20 crows outside my house recently, cawing nonstop for about 2 days straight. Driving me crazy. They're just like, gaw, 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 gaw. Finally, we called animal control. We were like, hey, what the hell's wrong with these birds? They said, it's baby crow season. They're cawing at the baby crows until they fly, and that can last up to 5 days. What? That's the crow flight training program? Just fly, 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 fly. And it works. 5 days, they were gone. Girl just snorted. Show's over. All right. I like it. We've taken it too far with cows, right? We kill them, we eat them, we wear them, then we eat their children. Then we drink their milk, which is the milk intended for their children we ate. We eat their babies, and then we eat their babies' food. Then, on top of all of that, we put pictures of our missing children on their milk. Hey, sorry about killing your kid. Haven't seen my kid, though, have you? Really worried about my kid. Your kid's dead. Ate him. Washed him down with his own food. Keep a lookout for my kid.
That was Ahmed Barucha with a portion of a piece called Crows and Cows, taken from an appearance at the Laugh Factory. On to Frank Cherubino to hear about his now infamous iguana experience during last week's cold snap. This is Frank Cherubino on Talking Animals. Good morning, Frank.
Hi, good morning. How you doing?
Good. Thanks for joining me on Talking Animals. So to set the scene for us, it's last week. It's Thursday, I believe. There's a cold snap in South Florida. Take us through from there.
Okay, so I'm getting ready to go to work. It's about 7:30 in the morning, about 40 degrees outside, and I look out my back window, and I see this bright swath of green on the edge of my pool, and I go out there, and it's an iguana that I've seen before. He lives in the palm tree in my backyard, overhangs the pool, and is frequently the source of irritation because he uses my pool as his bathroom. But anyway, I see him and his tail is in the water, and he's upside down on his back, and he's got his hands or his claws outstretched, and he's clearly frozen or petrified, I should say, not literally frozen, but the cold weather has immobilized him, and he's there on the edge of the pool. So I've had this happen before, and my experience is while the animal appears to be dead, it's really just in this state of suspended animation, in that when it warms up, or if it warms up in time, that he will sort of come back to life in a sense. So I kind of moved his tail out of the water and left him there on the deck. I have like this red Chicago brick and kind of waited. Figured I'd wait till I came home at the end of the day and see if he was still there, or if he had recovered. And
yeah.
My teenage son was home for the day, and I told him. And so what happened is that it warmed up. It got close to 50 degrees or so, and it warmed up sufficiently. There was sunlight and on the iguana there, and he got to a point where he started moving, and just very slowly. My son actually took a video of him slowly walking off the patio, and that's the last I saw of him. So so I assume he's okay. He's rebounded and just had a little tough moment there.
Yeah. With the photo that you took in the morning there before you went off to work and he was kind of still stretched out, looking a bit stunned or uncertain status, I guess.
Yeah.
That seemed to really take off, I guess. I mean,
I was a little surprised. I mean, I have a Twitter account, at Frankly Florida, a little ad for it there.
I
posted it on my Twitter and didn't think much of it. Thought, well, this is our idea of a cold front here, is we have iguanas that fall from trees and end up. But within no time at all, you know, got a call from the Associated Press and they wanted the photo, and then the New York Times interviewed me, and then it just kind of went from there. And pretty soon it was, you know, I'm getting contacted by Newsweek and TMZ and some TV station in India and Russia Today, and then I think the Today Show had it the next morning, and then Jimmy Kimmel made it part of his monologue on Friday night, where he talked about how no matter how crazy things get, Florida can out crazy you, and use the falling iguanas as the example of that.
No, it really was everywhere, and you did write a column about it. I put a link into the column in a couple of Facebook posts last night if people want to check that out. But so, I guess one of the questions I have by way of follow up is: have you seen that iguana since anywhere?
No, I haven't.
Okay,
and we have a there's a neighborhood tomcat that kind of patrols my yard and the several around us, and he's always scouring the bushes looking for rodents, anything else he can find. And so the fact that he hasn't dragged the iguana out of the bushes kind of tells me that that the iguana's back in the tree, living his happy iguana life again, and the temperatures have climbed up into the 70s now during the day, so
right.
He's a lot happier.
And do you feel a strange sort of kinship with the iguana just based on this experience? Or
I really was irritated with the iguana, and there was a moment, you know, be honest with you, there's a moment there when I saw him petrified there. It's like, now I've got you where I want you. I can really get rid of this problem instantly. Now I can take you out to the trash collection. The garbage man was coming that day. I had my garbage at the roadside. I could have taken them out. And you know, the law is really weird with iguanas. You know, they're exotic here, so they're not protected at all. And as a matter of fact, you're perfectly within your rights to kill them if you want, but you can't take them someplace else. You can't transport them because they are exotic, and the idea is not to spread them in other areas. So if I wanted to say, well, the humane thing to do would be, you know, I don't like this iguana using my pool as a bathroom and doing other things, that, you know, eating hibiscus flowers and all this other stuff, I could just take them to a nice park. There's a park that's, you know, not very far from my house, and he can live very happily in this park. But that would actually be against the law. You can't transport an iguana because they're exotic, and the idea is not to spread them. So you have to deal with them on your property, either alive or otherwise.
Wow. Well, we're just about out of time here, Frank, but I somehow think there's going to be another chapter to this saga, and we'll look forward to hearing that.
I hope that's the last thing.
Okay. Well, Frank, thanks so much for sharing that with us on Talking Animals, and take care. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, we have just about reached the end of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. If you would like to see tickets to see Mark Price, the comedy show at the Attic, call 813-239-9663. Thanks, I have one pair.